Ezra 1, verses 1 to 11.
Cyrus helps the exiles to return. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken to Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and put it in writing. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says: The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any one of his people among you, may his God be with you, and let him go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem. And the people of any place where survivors may now be living are to provide him with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. Then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved, prepared to go up and build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. All their neighbours assisted them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with valuable gifts, in addition to all the freewill offerings. Moreover, King Cyrus brought out the articles belonging to the temple of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and had placed in the temple of his God. Cyrus, king of Persia, had them brought by Mithridath, the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. This was the inventory: gold dishes, 30, silver dishes, 1,000, silver pans, 29, gold bowls, 30, matching silver bowls, 410, other articles, 1,000. In all, there were 5,400 articles of gold and of silver. Sheshbazzar brought all these along when the exiles came up from Babylon to Jerusalem.
Morning. So if you've got Ezra to hand, you might want to just keep it open, or particularly, I'm going to come back to Ezra chapter 1, verse 1 in a moment. But I wonder whether you ever ask the question, or reflect on the question, about what tomorrow brings. What's tomorrow going to bring? Who knows what tomorrow brings?
Doesn't look good from here when you listen to the news.
We're going to come to that. It's a question that we all face at different times of our lives, isn't it? Who knows what tomorrow brings? Whether that's a really mundane thing about who knows what you're going to pick up when you go to work tomorrow, or go to the shops, whatever it is you're going to do tomorrow. Or whether that's a profound thing about who knows what tomorrow brings, in the sense of career, or who you might meet and marry in the future, where you might develop your education. Who knows what tomorrow brings? And it's a question that is asked by people of faith and people without faith. It's a universal question in that sense, isn't it? Because none of us knows what tomorrow brings. A quick Google search revealed 4 secular songs with lyrics that contain that phrase. Anybody, without Googling, anybody know any of those artists, any of those songs? Okay, who sang that?
It's just that where we belong. I don't know who sang it. I've got it in my head now, though.
Okay, well, I found 4, and I haven't got a clue which one this was. I've got a feeling that's Marianne Black, who's more of a kind of, coming out of a kind of country kind of, and folk kind of scene. But there was also, this definitely wasn't Gary Moore, who sang a song, which is much more rocky, or Joe Cocker. I don't think that was Joe Cocker either that you've just quoted. Has he?
I think he's sung that.
He may have done, I don't know. And there's another group called Traffic from the 1980s. They all sang songs that contain those lyrics. Who knows what tomorrow brings? And you're going to hate me by the end of the day when you can't get that out of your head. But there are some things that we can be pretty sure about what tomorrow is going to bring, aren't there? Anybody have any expectations that tomorrow morning the sun will not rise in the sky? Anybody not expect there to be some kind of weather tomorrow? And anybody not expect the weather presenters to have got at least some of it wrong? Who knows what tomorrow brings? I'm pretty sure, whether I deserve it or not, that my wife will love me tomorrow. But I'm not in control of that. I've got to get through the rest of today. I'm pretty sure there's enough in our cupboards and fridge that when we go home later we can make a meal. I'm pretty sure that when I turn on the tap, water will come out. I'm pretty sure that tomorrow, at least one of the newspapers, as part of its front page, will be talking about Brexit. And the fact that the politicians can't agree and have got no idea which way to go forward. There are some things that we can expect tomorrow will bring because we have a history of seeing those things in the past. We know that the sun's going to rise tomorrow because for every other day that we can imagine, the sun has risen. And based on that past experience, we look forward and say, I'm pretty sure it's going to continue in that vein. So we base our expectations on the things that are going to happen on the history of how they've happened previously. And that gives us an expectation. And I guess most of us don't question or think about those things that we just take for granted. When was the last time you got up in the morning and you gave thanks to God that the sun was shining in the sky? Well, after 3 months of rain or whatever it might be, you might do that because it's unusual. In this country, if you've planned a camping trip or a barbecue, you might give thanks that on the particular day that there is sunshine in the sky. But for most of us, day by day, when we're in the routine of going to work or school or whatever it might be that we're doing, we get up, we get in the car, we travel to wherever we're going, and we just kind of accept that's how it's going to be that day. We don't think about it. We just accept it. And that sense of our expectations for tomorrow based on the past are a world away from those things that we not just expect, but that we hope might happen tomorrow. That we desire might be different tomorrow. Our wishes are those things that we would like to happen. But they're a wish because we have no experience of them happening before. So they remain a hope rather than an expectation. We have no real basis upon which we might expect that tomorrow might be different than it was today. But sometimes we hold on to that wish regardless, don't we? If they happened, if that thing that I wish for happened, that can make a real difference in the world. Maybe in my life, maybe in your lives, maybe somewhere in the world. It's the appeal, the enduring appeal that some people feel drawn to for the lottery. And the addiction to gambling. The hope, the wish that if I do this, take this risk, tomorrow might be different. So let me ask us this morning, what are you wishing for? What are you wishing for? What have you got no expectation might actually happen, but you would love to see it, if it did? What are you wishing for? I wish my shirts would iron themselves. There is no expectation from the past that's ever happened, but I wish it was the case for tomorrow. I wish my boys would eat vegetables while they're away at uni. I've got nothing to base that upon as an expectation, based on how they lived last year. But I can wish it nonetheless. I wish there was a peaceful solution in Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, or for the Rohingya people. But if I'm honest, I have no expectation that it will happen. So do you notice the difference between expectations and wishes? Expectations are based on history. But our wishes are based on a hope that something will change. Something tomorrow will be significantly different. Our hopes, our wishes, are all about change. It may be our hopes, it may be our dreams, it may be our deepest desires, but unless something changes, they will never happen. They will simply remain wishful thinking. And in Ezra's day, many of his fellow Jews had a lot of wishful thinking. Things that they hoped, longed for, dreamed for, wanted to see fulfilled, but had no real expectation that they would. They had the hopes and dreams of returning from being in captivity in Babylon to their ancestral home in Jerusalem. They prayed every day that God would restore them to Jerusalem. And they hoped that it might happen. We need to understand that the people in Ezra's day had been taken captive by the mighty Babylonian army. That the Babylonians had besieged their city, had torn down its walls after years of siege, had killed about 90% of the population, and those that remained had been carted off on a journey of about 1,000 miles to the city of Babylon. To us, 1,000 miles is a couple of days in the car or a short trip by plane. In their day, that was the other end of the world. And there was no prospect of returning home. They had no real expectation that they would ever see their homeland again. But they wished that it might be so. But they wished, in the face of expectation, that it might be so. And as they cried out to God and asked God to restore them, so their prayers became ritualized. I don't know how long you would keep up your prayers every day, asking for the same thing, over and over and over and over and over and over again. And how that impacts you when that doesn't change. Do you think you keep it up for 3 days? A week? A month? I know of situations where people have said they literally spent years praying for somebody. Maybe a family member. But they were so passionate that they would see that person come to a living faith in God, that they committed part of every day for years, that that might be the case. What about us? What are we praying for diligently, earnestly, for decades? And how does that impact us when we don't see the fruit of that prayer? Tough questions. But the Jews in Babylon have been praying for the best part of 70 years. 70. Can you imagine praying? I can't imagine praying for 7 years, let alone 70 years. For some of us, that's our entire lifetime. For some of us, that's multiples of our lifetime. For 70 years, they've been praying. And the question that they are wrestling with is, will we ever see our homeland again? Is this a false hope? Do we have any right for that expectation? What is God saying to us about this situation? Why would their captors, these Babylonians, ever change their policy towards the Jews? What could possibly change so that their dream might become a reality? Nothing happened yesterday to give us any hope that it might change tomorrow. But of course, there was a reason for hope. There was a reason for hope. It wasn't just a wish, but they had a hope that was based on a promise that change would take place. And it wasn't just a promise made between people. This isn't some kind of like pinky swear that, you know, if you do this, I'm going to do that, and we're going to be all right in the end. This was a promise made by God himself, without anything required on the part of his people. God had spoken in that darkest hour, as the walls were being torn down, as the land was being ravaged, as their children were being deported. God had spoken. As the temple was being ransacked, as Nebuchadnezzar's army was carting off all the articles that we read about in Ezra chapter 1, God was speaking. Unfortunately, only one person was listening. All the rest were too wrapped up in what was going on. Anybody know the name of the person who was listening? Jeremiah, thank you very much. And what was Jeremiah hearing? For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you, to give you a hope and a future. And more specifically, in 70 years, I will restore you. In 70 years, I will restore you. That text sound familiar to anybody? Anybody still using the bookmark we gave you out in January? With that text printed on it? Anybody still got it on their fridge? Paul's showing it to me now. Excellent. Do you want to give that a wave to remind people what it looks like? The fact you've got it with you here, does that mean that you don't look at it every day? Because it's on... It's you see it every week. It's better than none at all. You see, when God speaks, God just doesn't give a promise that's open-ended, ambiguous. God gave a cast iron promise. When the 70 years are up, I will restore you. It wasn't a someday, somehow kind of promise. It wasn't a we'll see what happens along the way kind of promise. It was a I have plans for you. I have a purpose for you. And despite how it feels right now, my plans and my purposes have not been thwarted by your circumstances. That was the basis of their hope. There was their future. And it's that moment of fulfillment that we're reading about here in Ezra chapter 1. In that first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, who fulfilled the word of the Lord. What word of the Lord? That prophecy given to Jeremiah. The Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation. This is what Cyrus says. The Lord. In our NIV it says the Lord. The Lord, the way it's printed here, means that in original Hebrew, it doesn't say the Lord. It says Yahweh. The name of God. The name that God revealed to Moses as his intimate family name. The name by which he can be known, to identify him from any other kind of God. The name of Yahweh. What does that tell us? That tells us that Cyrus has had an encounter with the living God. Just think about that for a second. How would we have responded, do you think, as a nation, if during the Second World War a church leader in Germany has stood up and said, I believe the Lord is saying this? Do you think that the church, the Christians in this country, would have said, oh yeah, that's a really good word from God? And if that church leader had said, hey, Britain, we're about to send all these waves of bombers over to you, and we're going to send all these rockets, and we're going to do devastating stuff to your country, but don't worry. God has a plan and a purpose for you. He hasn't finished with you yet. Do you think we would have taken any kind of comfort from that? Does that sound like a comforting notion? Or do you think that the Christian in this country would have kind of gone, what are they talking about? What could they possibly know? That can't be from God. Because God's on our side, not on their side. And to suggest otherwise, treason. Lock him up. Throw away the key. We have a very partisan view of who God is, don't we? We make God to be for us, which means, therefore, he's against everybody else sometimes. Particularly when that others are our enemies. And so this revelation to Cyrus comes as a bit of an inconvenient truth. God didn't speak to the leaders of the Jews that the time had come. Just as God didn't speak to the leaders of the Jews when they went into captivity. Instead, he spoke to his servant Nebuchadnezzar, who also knew the name of God. That's such an inconvenient truth to our theology. Oh my goodness, what are we going to do with that? It's such an inconvenient truth to our theology of what it means to be the promised people of God. Both in terms of the historical nation of Israel and to be part of the people of God. Because God sent Nebuchadnezzar to do what to the Jews in Israel? To destroy them. To destroy them. Why? Because they had rebelled against God. Okay, how does that work? Quick history lesson. So before God sent Nebuchadnezzar, God had said to the leaders in Israel, I'm sending the Babylonian army to you. And you're to welcome them. You're to embrace them. And if you welcome them and embrace them, I will not destroy you. And in that difficult period of their history, there were some wise leaders in their council who were saying to the king, and as part of his advisors, were saying, we need to listen to God and we need to do what's right by what God is revealing, by what God is saying. But there were only a few of them. The rest of them said, we don't need to listen to what God's saying. Because we've got a really, really, really strong friend called Egypt. And Egypt have promised that if the Babylonians come in our direction, they're going to stand with us and they're going to fight with us. And there's this really amazing, huge, humongous battle. And guess what happens? The Egyptians are destroyed. So what do the Babylonians do then? They say, who are the allies of these Egyptians? We don't like them anymore. They've had their chance. We're going to wipe them off the face of the earth. And God said, that's no random plan. That's my plan. Anybody's theology, what it means to be the people of God, being a little bit challenged this morning? Anybody's theology of the church as the extension of the promised people of God being challenged this morning? Because it should be. You see, God never promised that he would protect the church. Just as he sent destruction on the Jews, so God is equally able to send destruction on his church. Why? For exactly the same reasons. For exactly the same reasons. When the church is in rebellion to what God is saying, why would God hold back his destruction? When the church is in rebellion to what God is saying, why would God, in his justice and mercy, not treat the church today any differently to the way that he treated the Jews in the time of Nebuchadnezzar? But the fact remains that God is faithful. Not necessarily to individuals, but to his people as a collective. What does that mean? It means simply this. Don't feel you're safe if you're in rebellion against God. Don't feel being part of the church protects you if you're in rebellion against God. Because God has never promised to protect you under those circumstances. Destruction is a possibility. Cyrus's decree is astonishing on every level. Not only does he declare that the people are free to go back to Jerusalem, which in itself would be amazing, which in itself was amazing, but he says to them not only that, he says, I want you to go to the neighbours who are not going to return, Babylonian and Jew alike, and I want you to ask them for gifts, for the resources that you're going to need to re-establish your city, for gold and for silver and all sorts of other kinds of wealth. And you know what? They're going to give it to you. If your neighbour turned up on your doorstep and said, I think God's told me to go to Timbuktu, not that there's a lot left of Timbuktu these days, but I believe God's told me to go to Timbuktu and to restore a temple to him there, and he's told me to come and ask you for a significant chunk of cash, would you go, who do I write the cheque out to? Or would you go, weirdo? Depending on which day, I might have either of those reactions. But not only has Cyrus said, go and ask your neighbours for some cash, he's also said, I want to restore the temple in Jerusalem. And I want to give you all the things that my ancestor Nebuchadnezzar had stolen from them. Whoa, hang on a second. This means that Cyrus wants to restore the Jews in their promised land. But not only that, he wants to restore them as a functioning community who have the economic means of survival. But not only that, he wants to restore them as a worshipping community, so that they can be worshipping the God that he's come to know. God's promise to Jeremiah is being fulfilled. I have plans for you. Plans to prosper you. Well, I don't preach a prosperity gospel, but God gives the resources that are needed. Plans to give you a hope and a future, not just as an economic reality, but as a spiritually functioning community. The people of God have always been called to listen for the voice of God and to be a visionary people, moving forward in the plans and purposes of God as he reveals them. Not standing still or looking backwards. I remember a number of years ago now talking to another church leader. And I was saying, what's your idea of your ministry? How do you understand the nature of your ministry? And he thought about it for a short while and he said, I see my role as being a bit like a rugby player. Okay. Never come across that analogy before. What do you mean by that? He said, what I mean by that is that I take a few steps forward while I'm carrying the ball, and then I hit resistance, opposition. Something happens to stop me in my tracks. And I realise then that my time is up of carrying the ball. And my job then is to pass the ball backwards to the person who's waiting next in line. And their job then is to take a few paces forward until they're stopped and tackled. And their job then is to pass it backwards. I said, have you ever got any hope of scoring a try? And he said, I don't think that's my ministry. I think I'm called to be a faithful ball carrier. I'm just going to take a few steps and then I'll pass the ball along and let somebody else carry it forward. I said, what direction are your eyes focused on? Are they focused on the winning line? Or are you already looking over your shoulder at who's coming down the track, knowing where to pass the ball to? And he said, yeah, I'm looking over my shoulder, where I'm going to pass the ball to next. Friends, I want to say lovingly and respectfully, that is not biblical. That is not in the plans and purposes of God. That's not the calling of his church. Our eyes are never meant to be backwards looking, or even looking along the line. Our eyes are to be forward focused. There is a goal to aim for. There is a try line to be striving for. Now I'm going to say something that some of you are going to find difficult and possibly controversial. I believe the church in the West is being destroyed by God. I believe some of us sitting here are the remnant who will be saved. and the rest of us will probably die in captivity. What do I mean by that? What I mean is this. For too long, the church in the West has been looking backwards, has been relying on glory days in the past, has been holding to traditions, to practices, to attitudes and ideas that are not the will of God. That when choices were made along the way, we chose to side with Egypt, thinking that we can do it in our own strength and not relying on God. And so God is destroying his church in the West. But I also want to give hope. And our hope is found in the story of Ezra. And the fulfillment we read in Nehemiah. What does it take for that restoration to occur? I think it needs two things. The first is to listen to what God is actually saying. And my conviction is that God has promised that it won't be forever. But that the current generation will be decimated. What we believe we might be handing on to the next generation will not be what gets handed on to the next generation. And if it is, it will die. And that's not against God, that's God's plan. Why? Because I think there's a move of God that is taking place outside of the Western church. I think there's a move of God taking place in this community that we're not ready for, that we can't see, that we can't appreciate. It's happening in the homes of our neighbours, our work colleagues. A stirring in people's hearts of God restoring what he has always wanted to build. The trouble is that we can't see it. And some of us refuse to see it. And just as in Ezra's day, so generations had to die, so a new generation had to be born. I believe the hope of the church that God is revealing is in the hands of young people. It's in the hands of our young people. It's in the hands of our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. I'm not just saying they are the future. I'm saying more than that. I'm saying they are the remnant who will be restored. Now, I appreciate that's a tough message. And it's probably not the message you were expecting to hear this morning. It's probably definitely not the message you wanted to hear this morning. That doesn't make it not true. The question then becomes, will we become a visionary people? Will we become a visionary people that are prepared to listen to what God is revealing and to act in the way God is leading? Will we be a visionary people that looks to the next generation, however uncomfortable that makes us feel? Are we prepared to face the questions that I've raised about the real promises of God to his people and what that means for us as a congregation and for Western Christianity. And as always, we're faced with a choice in how we respond. And the choice in some ways becomes, I think, boils down to these two choices. We can be part of the death, or we can be part of the life. We can be part of the death, or we can be part of the life. And I generally wonder, for us as a church, but also for Western Christianity, which way we will go. Will we be inspired by the story of faith that we find in Scripture? By a God who speaks and reveals his plans and invites people into obedience? Will we pack up and ship out and build afresh in Jerusalem? Or are we settled in the comforts of Babylon? And are we prepared to die there? That's a choice that we each face. That's a choice we each must answer. I invite you to reflect on that question now.